everybody. It is June 17th. We have a very special guest with us today. We have the Honorable Kwanzaa Hall, who is running for Lieutenant Governor of Georgia. So stay tuned for this interview you do not want to miss.
People are dying because they're waiting on us. What are you going to do? What are you going to do?
Hey, you guys, we are back, and we have the Honorable. I keep calling you the Honorable because you, just so people know, you actually at one point actually served in Congress representing the state of Georgia for about, what, a month, was it?
Yeah, 33 days. John Lewis served 32 days. I completed his term in Congress, and it was, to date, my highest honor. Was to pick up the baton and be able to carry it over the finish line for someone who was a friend, a neighbor, a mentor of mine, and he and my father served in civil rights together. So I didn't plan to be running for Congress, but in those 33 days, we also did a lot of serious work because we did not have a budget, we did not have COVID relief, and we did not have even military spending. Ended up voting on $3 trillion and 18 pieces of legislation. I spoke in the well 25 times. It was a lot of work in 1 month, and I'm glad I was prepared from Atlanta City Council and School Board to be able to serve quickly, hit the ground running, no OJT, and help our citizens. And still that COVID relief money is sitting at the state. And that's one of the reasons why I'm running for Lieutenant Governor. We have billions of dollars that were expended to various states around the country, and many of them have not put the money to good use. It's just sitting in the bank accounts.
You know, it's interesting. Wow. You start off by mentioning your father, and one of the things I've learned in getting to know, well, offside of getting to know you, is that you have a deep root to Atlanta, and I don't think a lot of people know that. Reverend McDonald, who I just spoke to, literally just got the phone with, he talks about your father all the time. So just tell us a little about who Kwanzaa Hall is. Yeah. How did he come up in this Atlanta-born native?
Born and raised in Southwest Atlanta. I went to Atlanta Public Schools. Grew up in Venetian Hills, Adams Park neighborhood on the west side. I was born in quote unquote Adamsville. Mm-hmm. It was a black doctor's hospital called Holy Family, Southwest Hospital. Imagine we had an all black doctor's hospital back in the late 60s, early 70s. And some of our greatest physicians were operating out of there. And of course, many people were born at Grady or Crawford Long, but I was born there. My parents were from Chicago and Alabama. My father was the youngest member of Dr. King's staff. And he got kicked out of high school for organizing in Alabama, came to Atlanta, was brought here by Dr. King and Andrew Young, Hosea Williams. And my mother was from Chicago. She was an organizer there. They met organizing in Chicago and ended up having me and my brother. And we grew up, you know, being a part of the movement. You know, it was never a time when you didn't hear Coretta Scott King or John Lewis being over the house or other civil rights icons, known and unknown. The unsung heroes were very much in our place. James Orange, Reverend James Orange, who was a civil rights icon. Willie Bolden, Dorothy Tillman. I mean, there's so many of them, countless names of people who really gave their lives for us to have the benefits that we enjoy right now, the benefits that we're seeing being rolled back or potentially being rolled back, whether it be Roe v. Wade, whether it be voting rights and voter suppression, or just the way that we're seeing economic injustice continuing to persist in our society. So I feel I'm a son of Georgia, son of Atlanta, and one who has been, you know, trained up to be a public servant. I inherited this legacy of commitment to community. That's all we ever did growing up. I went away to college to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology after being president of Mays High School. But when I got to MIT, I went to do a science project. I wanted to get a patent on a plant. And I spent about a week or two in the lab and immediately knew that my calling was really leadership and was being a person who could help move communities forward. And all I longed for was getting back to Atlanta. And I came back here around 1995, 96 when the Olympics happened. Worked in county government, got involved in that space, and ultimately ended up running for school board in 2002. My father, on his deathbed at when I was 18, said, "Son, whatever you do, don't go into politics." So I avoided the political science department, right? It took me 10 years from 19, 89 to 99 to discover that what he was saying was not don't go into politics, but don't be a politician. Be a public servant. You, if you're going to be in a role like that, you have to be a steward and you have to care about people. And I ended up running for school board for that very reason. And then after school board, I ran for city council. Again, I couldn't achieve some of the things I wanted to do on the school board because of the bureaucracy, because of the challenges we had with getting the votes to align around helping children. I really feel like it's a travesty to see how urban education does such a disservice to so many young people. I was educated in the school system. It worked for me. It worked for a lot of us who went on to Ivy League schools and great HBCUs, but there's so many who still fall through the cracks, and many of them were smarter than I was. And they just didn't have the structure at home and the support from the system to get them through. And it's so sad to me when I look today at how where they are in life. But many of them are supporting my candidacy, and they believe that having a leader like me in the lieutenant governor's office will be a real marked change in our state. And we can do some of the things to help families and children who've been left out and left behind. One of our young leaders, I formed a youth group to stop the violence when I was in high school, because people wanted to start gangs. We didn't have gangs at that time in Atlanta. We just had neighborhood beefs. But who came through that, one of the people who came through that program was Killer Mike. And he always says that BTA, Black Teens for Advancement, was one of the groups that helped him to be on the right path and to discover his genius as a leader, as a thought-provoking advocate for what's right, for humanity, and to even become a rapper. So, you know, that kind of work is really what we need to have instilled in our society so we don't have generational poverty. Instead, we should have generational access to opportunities and growth and entrepreneurial endeavors that people can participate in, where they can create jobs in our communities that have been left out and left behind. You know, the communities that have the zip codes where people look like you and I don't tend to have the same amenities, don't tend to have the same access to education, for sure not the same access to health care or public safety or anything else. If it's going to change, it's up to us. I'm running for lieutenant governor because I believe that right now, at this point in our state's history, there's been 12 lieutenant governors. Mm-hmm. Not one of them looks like the three of us. And it's time that the diversity that our state reflects be reflected also, or that exists in our state, is reflected in the state capitol. And it also should be reflected in how the budget is expended. There's a $30 billion budget at the state. Less than 2% goes to minorities and women. Less than that percent goes to Black people. Black people make up more than 30% of our state. Minorities make up 50% total. Why don't we see that expenditure go into communities that look like ours? That would be $9 billion hidden in the Black community.
Right.
If 30% went there, what would that do for our economy? You know, we always talk about money going out of the Black community. This is a way to have money to come in and regenerate. Mayor Maynard Jackson helped create a multitude of millionaires, 40, almost 50 millionaires, when he decided to have a mandatory affirmative action program at the state. At the city. Atlanta needs that. Maynard Jackson had an affirmative action program where 30% of contracts, or 33% of contracts, would go to minorities and women. We exceeded that as during my service and my tenure. The state of Georgia does not have a similar program. We need a program like that, a program that speaks to affirmatively bringing people into the equation that has been a good old boys club, good old girls club. We've been shut out of that. This is back to the Georgia's agrarian and plantation past. Many of the companies still trace their lineages there. These same companies that are the titans of industry in Georgia benefit most from the state budget. A lieutenant governor can stand in the well if they have courage and they're not afraid to speak truth to power and say, whenever a piece of legislation comes up, what are we doing about minority participation? And this paper isn't moving until we have the right conversation about that. And that's being stubborn about what should be done right. And that's what Maynard Jackson did. It cost him his career for a period of time because no one wanted to hire him after he came out of office. But he changed Georgia, he changed the world permanently, because many cities and states around the country, counties, adopted that affirmative action program. So it takes someone to stand up in the well and have courage. What the lieutenant governor does is act very much like the vice president. One, you're one heartbeat away from being governor if the governor ever becomes incapacitated. Number two, you're in a position where you preside over the Senate, like we see the vice president doing, we see council presidents doing, and you act as traffic cop, moving the legislation and the legislative process along during the time period, the 40-day period that you have. In addition to that, you appoint committee chairs. And if you're empowered to have other resources and powers by the body, that means you have to have rapport and relationships with a body that will more than likely be Republican. I have a lot of those relationships because I served in the Central Business District. I represented downtown, midtown, 044, Inman Park. Those areas have right-wing leanings, but also because of the land ownership and because of the business community, the Chamber of Commerce, the corporations that are located there, I always had to engage with the Bernie Marcuses of the world, the Koch brothers, with many other real estate developers who have a lot of interest at the state and are very influential at the state. People from Carrollton and from South Georgia, and you'd be surprised who does business in Atlanta, but their domiciles are not. And those same individuals and corporations have a lot of influence at the state. I have a track record for, one, getting things done as a legislator. I passed over 750 pieces of legislation as a council member, and many of those pieces of legislation had bipartisan support. One of those was banning the box on felon reentry. We have so many individuals who come out of the penal system. They've been incarcerated. They're trying to get back on their lives, become successful, and take care of their families, get housing, but they can't because when they go to apply for a job, the box says, are you a felon? We removed that from the City of Atlanta applications. That same work I did with Koch brothers, I did with state legislators, and with Governor Deal, and through that process, the state passed it as well. We passed the criminalization of possession of less than an ounce of marijuana. We helped to create a solutions, not punishment, working with other organizations such ACLU and others to prevent individuals from going straight into into being incarcerated when all they really need is a diversion.
Right.
So pretrial diversion is another program that I rolled out. And I'm just excited about the opportunity to offer myself for more service at a time when we heard about all the shootings yesterday, and this stuff is happening in a way that's so alarming that it's going to require that leaders step up and speak out and be leaders like, you know, we haven't seen in a long time. And that's what I'm willing to offer myself up to do for this period of time, because if I don't do it, who will? You know, when I decided to run, there were 9 people in the race, and many people say, oh my God, why would you do that? But when I ran for Congress, it was 7 or 8 people in the race. We prevailed with over 207,000 votes. That was 80,000 more than our competitor. And there were several hundred thousand of other voters who were primarily African-American voters. The Democratic Party, especially Democratic primary, is 62%+ minority, and meaning African-American in particular. Why would we not want to see a person who can speak to our interests best be represented in that position? We have a unique opportunity to do that. I'm running to be the lieutenant governor that does things that we've never seen done in the state of Georgia. I will work with the Republican leaders to get things done on behalf of our people, on behalf of the values that I stand for. I will also work with the governor. Hopefully it is a Democrat. If it is not, and it is Governor Kemp, I will have to figure a strategy on how to navigate and get things done with him as well. We'll work with the business community. And of course, we will work with the faith-based community and organizations such as Black Push. What needs to happen is Black Push needs to have a much louder voice and stake in state conversations. But how do you do that? It has to be someone who lets you in the door and gives you a seat at the table.
Right.
And gives you a full megaphone and microphone so you can really speak out about things that matter. Well, I'll be that leader who invites you down and gives you that first dibs on the conversation. Not the tail end, but
right.
You get the first interview. And then you break the news and you tell the story and you define the direction of the dialogue. Because more than likely, I can count on it and I can close my eyes and know that you're going to take it in the right direction. Because you're speaking about issues that matter to you all. And they matter to me. That's what a leader can do. There's tangible things in the law. And there's the bully pulpit, and there's the relationships, rapport, and ability to navigate government and navigate community power structures. I've already done this as a council member. I'm not looking for OJT. I've won 6 or 7 of the 8 elections I've run in. So, you know, it's not like I'm a newcomer and I haven't ever won anything, and I'm just talking about what I could do. I mean, we're going to beat Burt Jones in November. I'm clear about that. We have the numbers, and I think there's also moderates and Republicans who will come our way because I don't think they're excited about his former leadership. that he's a Trump elector. I was in Washington when they tried to take over our government, when they were going to overthrow and take a form a coup attempt. People like him don't need to have any more voice. These billionaire, well-privileged people, and there are a lot of them, they're Democrats and Republicans who have a lot of privilege. And some people get the benefit of being placed in elections whenever they want to be, with all the money and all the endorsements they need. When, you know, brothers and sisters been struggling, we got to figure it out. We got to make do, and we still do better. We had to make do through college, through high school, competing against others. But when we do actually compete, what happens? We do better in any sport, in any activity, given a fair shot. I'm running so that we have a fair shot.
You know, one of the things that I think that is extremely important is I don't think people understand the power that lies within the Lieutenant Governor's office. So you mentioned earlier how it's kind of almost like the Vice President who oversees the Senate. But we understand the Vice President is not day-to-day in the Senate, right? Mm-hmm. She's there to break ties. She doesn't determine what legislation goes through. Majority leader does that. Mm-hmm. But in Georgia, it's different because the Lieutenant Governor can actually decide what comes on the floor and what does not show itself on the floor.
Exactly, and that was my point about holding it in the breast. So we would call it holding in the breast of the council. When a paper came up that a council president didn't like or the council members wanted to fight about, you could like try to push it back. And some things get held forever.
Right.
Well, in this case, Lieutenant Governor Duncan sent the Buckhead bill to the Urban Affairs Committee and that froze the paper.
Yeah.
So you do have that prerogative. But if you really want to be powerful, in terms of helping people and leverage that position, whether you're in the party that has the control or not, whenever a paper comes up, you call the questions on the items that matter most to you and your stakeholders.
Right.
So we'll always be talking about reparations. We'll always be talking about restorative justice. We'll always be talking about access to the $30 billion spend that should go to minorities and women. We'll always be talking about justice reform in a way that we have not seen it. We'll always be talking about ensuring that we have communities that have been left out and left behind getting the same level of benefit that everyone else we know with privilege has gotten. And that's not right. I mean, it's not right that we've had to live this long and see this many generations of families living all over Georgia, living in abject poverty, whether it's on Boulevard or whether it's in Riceboro. You know, we have to change that. And it takes leaders who have enough courage to say it, number one, but then act on it and then use their power and be firm and steadfast and stubborn until it gets done.
You know, one of the things that's interesting to me is that Georgia ranks, I think I read an article last night where we ranked like number 46 in healthcare. And literally, we have billions of dollars that's sitting there in Medicaid that the state of Georgia, that the citizens already paid for. I mean, if you're paying taxes in the country, those taxes are paying for Medicaid regardless. And the governor, we know, the current governor, will not take those funds for Medicaid. What is your view of how Georgia can move the healthcare system forward to where everybody has access to affordable healthcare?
So I frame healthcare just like any other investment as a potential economic driver. I've done master plans where I created a strategy working with various communities, leaders, stakeholders, landowners, entities to devise a way that we would attract capital to our part of town where I represented. Over $2 billion went to District 2 during the time I served. We could do the same thing in Georgia with a healthcare master plan. So I've rolled out a concept, the Kwanzaa Hall Prosperity for All plan. And in that, we have healthcare and economic development investment. We invest in healthcare from the perspective of what it will do for the various parts of the state. So when I start talking about healthcare, and you say just expand Medicare, whatever, if I'm a Republican, they're going to say, I'm not doing that because it's a lightning rod. But if I say I want to make an economic development investment through this plan and this strategy in your area, and it's going to bring X number of jobs, and it's going to give your people this much more access to health care, because I know in your community you already saw a rural hospital close, or the prices are too high, or a combination of that, here's what you get. There's no one offering that right now. It's always a hard this way or that way. And when it's my way or the highway, you don't get a win.
Right.
We've got to come up with a winning compromise that everyone gets a benefit from, because it's really all about all Georgians winning. It's black and white people. Right. It's rich and poor in these rural communities in suburban. We just had a hospital close in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. I was on the board of Atlanta Medical Center, which ultimately got bought by Tenet. Mm-hmm. and now I'm not no longer on the board, but it was a travesty to hear that that hospital was closing, because it is in an area that has not only food desert, you know, low income, low access to transportation, low access to health care, low access to educational attainment, no investment, disinvestment, and the hospital goes. Something's wrong with the economic engine there. We don't have an economic plan, a development plan that's going to change the trajectory of that community. And there's hundreds of communities like that, at least one or two in every county. Every one of those 159 counties, or there may be a couple that overlap in one, three or four counties because they're much more rural. But that's what we need a plan for. Take the least developed and invested and supported part of our state and give them the investment they deserve so that everybody feels that rising tide. And when everybody feels the rising tide, those who have the most get more too. But if those at the top get the most and everybody else gets nothing, then we're still creating this big, you know, big I's and little U's and haves and have nots, and then you get more crime because people are like, look at what all you have and look at what we don't have. And we don't have to have that kind of crime model if people actually have a pathway to success, access to broadband, access to the internet. Young people who have access to innovation will make their own path. We saw during COVID, during the pandemic, when people had a chance to sit at home and get on the computer and learn how to use all the devices and do their own podcast, they started doing what? First, creating content. They turned their content into revenue. They monetized their creative talents. That's what everybody wants to do. Self-determination. One of the principles of Kwanzaa. So I believe we have a unique opportunity right now to do some things in our state we've never done before. I'm running for lieutenant governor to do that. I want to have partners like Black Push at the table with me, partners like First Iconium and Reverend Tim McDonald and so many others who've already offered to be a part of the equation. But I just got a wonderful endorsement from Brian Miller. He is the grandson of former Lieutenant Governor Zell Miller, who also went on to become a senator. So we are getting support from base groups that wouldn't normally be supporting a candidate like me from Atlanta. He's in North Georgia. We got the endorsement of Edna Jackson, former mayor of Savannah, and she's now a representative. We got the endorsement of current mayor of Savannah, Van Johnson. So we're getting support all over our state, and I'm so proud and just humbled by the fact that so many individuals believe in what our candidacy stands for. It's not about Kwanzaa as a big I. It's just about me as the, I'm the tip of the spear to try to make this change happen in our state. And I'm willing and available to do it because we're, you know, many are chosen, but few are called. And I feel that I was called to do this. And the more I think about it, the more I pray, the more energy and mud and muck that's been thrown at our campaign by our opponents and their forces lets me know that we're doing the right thing. Because if we weren't doing the right thing and we were not serious, serious in terms of setting the state on a different course,
right,
we would not be even feeling this energy.
You know, what's interesting is that I talk to every candidate about this, that I'm from Florida. So constitutionally, as a citizen of the state of Florida, if I decide that, hey, I want to raise minimum wage from $7.25 to $12 an hour, as a citizen of that state, I'm able to do what they call a ballot initiative, meaning I can get 100,000 votes, mm-hmm. and it actually brings its way to the ballot, and we get to vote on it as a state. Mm-hmm. In Georgia, that's unconstitutional, which to me is interesting because we kind of see, like, SB 202 and all these other bills. Seems like Georgia is taking a path of shutting up the citizens more so, and kind of this mentality that, don't worry about it, we got you, we'll take care of it. Mm-hmm. But if we had voter initiative or ballot initiative, we probably would have passed things as far as minimum wage increase. We probably would have accepted the Medicaid expansion. There would be a lot of different things that as citizens we could bring to the ballot. And probably even the whole gun carrying permit or gun list or carrying permit, whatever, uh-huh. the law that brought
carrying.
Yeah. I think all that stuff could have been avoided. How do you feel about being able to, and I know it's a huge task, but just from the perspective, how do you feel about having an initiative to where citizens are able to bring stuff to the ballot if they can get enough people to sign on board with it?
Well, first I'll say, you know, there have been a lot of initiatives like $15 an hour that I helped pass as a city councilman. And to see that we still haven't passed a lot of those, decriminalization of possession of less than an ounce of marijuana, none of that stuff is passed at the state. We introduced rent control. We couldn't get it through at the state. Okay. Now we have an opportunity to do that. I believe that innovation in terms of allowing citizen participation, such as what you described and other forms, are very necessary.
Right.
How people get access to the budget and the details and how you put the information on the internet, very necessary. But what I have to also acknowledge, the formation of Georgia, the culture of Georgia does speak to, it's still a clubby environment. It's a closed door way that things get done. The question is, if you have people who are in the club or in the closed door or sitting at the table who have interests that speak to more of the people, then you still can negotiate and leverage for those things. Right now, we're just starting to get people at the table. But even when we get people at the table, they don't necessarily put the agenda on the table like they should.
Right.
Okay. And because they want to stay at the table. And I think sometimes you got to be willing to get kicked out of the room and kicked out of the table for things that you believe in. As we know, Reverend Tim does, as my father did, as I've done even on other issues. So there, I support it, but there is, we've got to enlighten our elected leaders. We've got to enlighten our community stakeholders on a vision for how our state can be better by making changes and evolving from where it's been. Right now, people don't know when they hear an idea of, you know, defund the police, the negative branding of that hurt the solution, the mission.
Right.
And I think that's what we have to be very careful of. Agenda items that sound good in California and in New York or in other parts of the state,
don't work
country,
in the South.
They don't work in the South, and they don't work for Georgia.
You know, it's funny because I have a friend of mine who's a senator in state in the state of Florida, and he had been pushing for legislation. And I forgot what the legislation did, but it just passed in Florida.
Okay.
And the governor did not even invite him when he was the co-signer of the bill, did not even invite him to the signing of the bill, and took credit for it. And it has something to do with, I think, officers down there. But he had been pushing for this for years, and he was the driving force behind it and didn't even get invited because politics is so toxic right now. And I know I'm going to shoot over to James. I know he probably has a question, but I want to just say, man, keep running the race. And like I tell everybody who comes on the show, remember that people, we have 2 years of COVID, people want to be touched.
Yes.
And people want to see you not on the screen like we have here, but they want to see you in the front yards talking about the real issues that matter to regular Georgians every day.
Yes.
And we have a lot of issues, and we need people who are willing to give a voice to those. I'm sorry, James.
Yeah, so the question that comes to mind as I listen to you talk, is it a question of the good old boys club, if you will, doing business as usual, and people not voting their best interest, or willing to vote, let me paraphrase, willing to cut off their nose to spite their face, which is why things aren't getting done to the benefit of the general public for the people of Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
Is that possibly the case of what we're looking at?
Well, you know, I believe that most people who run for office run because they want to make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
But you get in there and you discover that it's not exactly what you thought.
Absolutely.
You run into the bureaucratic mess of whatever body it is. And then you run into cross-border skirmish politics of human beings. You know, some is sandbox human being issues, and then some is ideological agenda-based, okay? All three can be occurring at the same time. And sometimes people get there and they feel all of that energy and they're just like, man, is it even worth the fight?
Right.
And they just devolve down to the lesser battles because it's less stressful, less painful. One blessing that I have is we've focused on raising money in a way that we don't really have a lot of obligations. So we're winning without like the money being able to tell us what to do.
Right.
And that's a good thing. We're on the outs with that some of that crowd, and that's a great place to be. And then knowing how to navigate the power structures in general, because it is like a sea filled with deadly sharks and everything. And one has to know how not to get caught in a cross.
Right.
And you get to the table, you get shot once or twice by something from the back, you're not expecting it, and then you tend to want to sit down too.
Right.
But if you go in already knowing you're going for war, and it's all in all, that's my strategy right now. I'm going in for, we're going to have a conversation from day one, two, three, four, every second I'm there, the conversation is about what it's supposed to be about. And I know some of the players, I know who to call, and many of the players who sit at the table are heavily influenced by other people who are not at the table. Okay. So you got to know how to who's the uncle,
right?
Who's the other player? Who's the landowner? Who was the OG in that area? You know, you call an OG in our right. community. You find the OGs and you say, okay, look, can we really talk about what we need to talk about? Well, we thought y'all were saying this. Well, that's not even what we're saying. So you find out the beef was a miscommunication.
Right.
That's one part. Then it's, okay, we're talking apples to apple. What do you need? Well, we need 5 apples. Well, there's only 4. Well, can we have no apples? Can we have one and you have, you know, and then we do onesies and twosies? So those kind of conversations is what I think sometimes people get so dug in, they can't have a truce meeting. And when you have it, the truce meetings aren't about one thing. You got to have a truce meeting about, here's where we're coming from.
Right.
Here's where you're coming from. Okay, so can we agree on? You know, and what win did we have in the past that we can celebrate now? And that's what I've been able to do as a young leader when we went to, you know, protest in Forsyth County and the March Against Fear, where I organized the youth with Jose Williams when I was 16 years old, or when we formed a youth group to stop the violence. Killer Mike and so many other people went through. We were all, everybody was about to start gangs. But we got everybody at the table and we said, okay, how do we do something different? And that's, if you can do that in your own community, I've done it as a council member with neighborhoods in Emmett Park who are lawyered up, fighting with developers who are lawyered up, and the mayor's office having an agenda, and the council members having an agenda. And all of us having to sit in the room and say, okay, how are we going to get a win-win? But because it was in my district, if I didn't deliver upon it, I lose the most.
Right.
You know, the mayor at the time could go on, and the council members who are not in the district, they can go on, whether they're throwing rocks for or against. And the developers can go on. But I got to live with the community and the voters.
Right.
Right? So I had to always make sure that we, and I did my very best. I can't say every deal got to be a perfect win-win, but that was always my objective, and that's how my leadership style. It's one of, can we create a scenario where we have a shared vision, regardless of our differences and our backgrounds and our cultural norms? Let's first understand those, and then go, because I'm going to go visit every senator. I'm going to introduce myself. You know, many I know, but I'll go to their town, and I'm Kwanzaa Hall. I'm a child of civil rights movement. Folks, I'm not afraid of anything, so let's don't even start on that tone, you know. And also, but I like to get things done. I've helped people. I don't have a mark on your back just because you happen to be a Republican and you have a different hue and you live in a different part of the state and you drive trucks and I don't, or you carry guns, I do too. So what? I mean, so can we have a real conversation? What do you need? Here's what we need. And can we make it a win-win? And are we going to be honorable in our conversations with one another? Or are you going to tell me something here and you walk out of the room and your word's not bond? All that on the table, hands on the table. You do that with everybody, regardless of party. And that's how a leader should do. Right. You talk to every player on your team. Because if it's about ourselves, that's one thing. If it's just about our town, that's another thing. If it's about our interests, it's another thing. But the real thing it's supposed to be about is our state,
right,
and our citizens. So if you put that on the table, we're all working for Georgia. We all want to see our citizens win. It's not a big eye. I don't have to get all the credit. Hey, what can we agree on right now? That's Kwanzaa Hall. And I believe my style of leadership, my track record, my experience, my natural innate ability to connect with all kinds of human beings, regardless of background, is going to be very valuable and helpful in our state, based on the place where we are in the country and in the world, with all this division, all this strife, all this violence in our community. Man, we can do better.
Yeah, and we have to do better.
Definitely.
Man, Mr. Hall, I am so appreciative for you coming today. I want to remind everybody, if you want to know more about Kwanzaa Hall and what he stands for, you can go to his website at www.kwanzaahall.com. And remember that we are early voting right now. If you have not voted yet, you still have the opportunity to. I went and voted last night. I got my vote in. We need to make sure everybody cast their ballot. And if you voted, find 5 friends that have not voted and get them to the poll. And they need help. Tell them to call us here at Black Pushing. We would definitely help them get a ride there to the poll or whatever we have to do. But June 21st is a runoff election, and it's just as vital as the election that we just had a month ago. We are just encouraged, and thank you for your time. Thank you for coming out, and keep running your race. And I just seen you yesterday, literally, on the phone call with the Cal Pastors Alliance.
Yep.
So we want to just continue to wish him well. And remember, you can go and check them out at www.kwanzahall.com. Also, stay tuned to Black Push's Facebook page, our website. We have two major events coming up. We're going to Macon on June 25th for our One Accord Conference, but we will have Pastor Bumpus and so many other people, Shannon Jones going down there with us. And then we turn around in July 15th, where we host our where we host our Black Push inaugural gala, our evening of service, where we'll be honoring people like Zenona Clayton, Ambassador Young, Reverend Timothy McDonald, Shannon Jones, Sandra Lee Williams, Latasha Brown, Helen Butler. Did I miss anybody? Deborah Scott. So we're doing that at the Omni on July 16th. You don't want to miss it. And we have a very special entertainer, Avery Ditson, our own talented America's Got Talent superstar who got the Golden Buzzer. We'll be performing and putting on a serenade there. So check out these videos, and we look forward to seeing you guys soon. Please stay in touch.
We have stepped into the baptism of this movement.
Yes.
And we are saying, here we are.
Here we are.
Here we are. You need feet, here are our feet. You need arms, here are our arms. You need a mouth to speak truth to power. Here is our mouth.
Yes.
You need a heart that loves justice, that loves righteousness, that loves mercy, and that hates evil and injustice. Here are our hearts. Not, Lord God, from this very moment, do a work that transforms us. Let us not rest until we see victory. Let us not sleep until we see victory. Let us not sit down until we see victory. And so how can we stand? We'll stand by the power that you put in the man that sat in this room. Who stand because of the anointing that you placed on him. And we're asking you to put it right now on this august mountain. And we're asking that you let us multiply and let us grow to the far ends of this state and throughout this nation. We pray now for your transformation, for your change, and for the victory that is ours.
Speak truth to power.
If we live by what his word says, we're not going to go wrong.
Every human being deserves equal treatment.
If you don't know Vincent's name in your own community, don't call George's name.
Where is the church today?
One is a church, one is a package store. Which one is the greater influence?
We've got to put our foot down and say, as for me and my house, not only will we serve the Lord, but we'll look like him.
One Accord is what we need.
Stand up for all of God's children, and let's be a one Accord.
The thing about unity with God is that it doesn't come without unity with other people.
May the God in all of us stand with those who are the most vulnerable.
I believe the opportunity to be on One Accord is opportunity.
When am I going to stop? I'm going to stop when there's no more homeless people. When am I going to stop? I'm going to stop when people no longer have to be afraid to go into a ballot place and cast their ballot. When my white brothers and sisters don't have to eat from Dollar General, and that's where they get their only meal from.